on IRIB English Radio.
Social networking sites in Saudi Arabia went frenzy last week by news of an explosion heard in the Saudi capital Riyadh, with claims about Saudi air defenses intercepting a missile said to have been launched from Yemen. However, Wilayat al-Wa'd al-Haq, which is a previously largely unknown Iraqi resistance group, said it targeted Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the Daesh Baghdad market bomb that killed 32 Iraqis. Riyadh under drone attacks in this following report. Saudi Arabia announced that it intercepted and destroyed a hostile air target over Riyadh on January 23rd. The Saudi government did not provide additional details on who conducted the attack or from which direction it came. Saudi media only reported that residents in central Riyadh heard the explosion overhead and implied attribution for the attack to the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance group. However, a previously unknown Iraqi resistance group, Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq, which translates to the Righteous Promise Brigades, claimed responsibility for the attack. An Iraqi telegram channel claimed the group targeted Al-Yamama Palace, the official residence of Saudi King Salman bin Abdul Aziz, with a fixed-wing kamikaze drone. The statement blamed Saudi Arabia for supporting Daesh and indicated that Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq may next attack the United Arab Emirates unless Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, quote, cease their crimes, unquote. Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq indicated that the attack was part of the Balanced Deterrence campaign, which the Yemeni Ansarullah had launched in 2019 to retaliate against high-value targets in Saudi Arabia, such as critical oil infrastructure and defense assets. Ansarullah had always framed their Balanced Deterrence attacks as a response to the Saudi-led coalition's continued air campaign and blockade in Yemen, and had timed their previous attacks as retaliation for Saudi strikes that caused mass civilian casualties. Similarly, the Iraqi Alwiyat Wa'd al-Haq stated that its drone attack was the beginning of the transfer of Balanced Deterrence to the center of Saudi Arabia in revenge for the blood of the martyrs. It is worth noting that this attack came 2 days after Daesh, which Saudi Arabia supports and funds, conducted a mass casualty terrorist attack in Baghdad at the hands of a Saudi Wahhabi Takfiri terrorist. Experts believe that these weaponized drones are for sure a game changer since they operate like floating munitions. They are comparatively inexpensive and expendable and carry around 30 kilograms of explosives, enough to do some damage but limited in their potential destructive capacity, however enough to make Mohammed bin Salman sleep with one eye open. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ali Murad, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Ali. So, an Iraqi resistance group claimed responsibility for the kamikaze drone attack into Saudi Arabia on January 23rd for the second time in recent years, coming from Iraq. But we are used to news like this coming out of the Yemeni retaliation against the ongoing Saudi brutality and aggression against the people of Yemen. However, what is the significance of such an attack coming from Iraq this time?
Thank you. I think that, as you mentioned, we are used to press releases by the spokesman of the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, to come out and tell the world that Yemen launched missiles attacking some sites, military sites, or even oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia in retaliation of the aggression, the continuous Saudi aggression on Yemen. But this time, it was remarkable that Sana'a immediately denied that it has launched any missiles or any military operations in the Saudi lands. So we saw this press release of the Alwiyat al-Wa'd al-Haq, which is a new group. It's the first time we hear about this name. There's nothing confirmed up to now, but in case this was really an Iraqi group, this means that the era of retaliating against the Saudi aggression and the sending of the suicide bombers inside Iraq and funding ISIS and other Takfiri groups to mess in the Iraqi places, though, this means that the Iraqis have took the decision to stand for this game that is, which is obviously trying to play it again, because they played it before in Iraq and in Syria, mm-hmm. and people thought that after the defeat of the ISIS caliphate that Saudi Arabia and the Americans are not going to repeat the whole movie again. But it seems that on the first day of the Biden inauguration, ISIS attacked inside Baghdad, killing like 32 mm-hmm. Iraqis. And it happens that one of the attackers, the suicide bombers, was a Saudi national. So the Iraqis have the full right to retaliate against any Saudi aggression that attacks the Iraqi civilians or facilities, because the Iraqis know exactly what it means that Saudi Arabians, the Saudi regime, I'm talking about the Saudi regime, has mm-hmm. blood, Iraqi blood on his hands.
Well, what's interesting is that just days after this drone attack against Riyadh, we heard and saw U.S. President Joe Biden temporarily freezing arms sales to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates in the wake of the humanitarian crisis inside of Yemen and the continuous Saudi-led war against the Yemeni people. Do you think that this decision will actually prompt maybe Mohammed bin Salman to halt his war games in the region for a bit?
You know, the people close to the Biden administration and the Democrats in general, they are trying to convince us that the Democrats and the Biden administration truly wants to end the war on Yemen. We have to remember all the time that the Democrats, the Obama administration, was the one that
started the war.
It was declared from Washington, and the Obama National Security Advisor went out to the press and talked about the operation, the decisive storm. I think that the Biden administration wants to send some messages to the world in a approach to to renovate the abilities of the United States in soft power and after what Trump has made to the diplomatic relations with America's allies and also the foes. So I think that they are trying to show that there is a new administration that will work differently from the previous administration. So yeah, we will halt or freeze the arms shipments to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but there is one point that has to be taken into consideration. The true intentions of the Biden administration might be concerning some suspicions of corruption. Mm-hmm. Because before Pompeo left the State Department by 2 months, the Inspector General in the State Department was fired, because he launched an internal investigation about accusations for Pompeo of having some funds, some corruption funds from the Saudi and the UAE regimes mm-hmm. To pass those arms shipments. So I think that the Biden administration wants to invest in this to show the world that they are keeping their words and their promises during the campaign, the presidential campaign, and they want to stop this war. So the press secretary in the White House went out and said some strategic goals has mm-hmm. to be met, and part of them stopping the war on Yemen.
Well, he didn't actually say stopping the war. He actually said an attempt to end the warring factions. Yeah. He didn't even say stop the war. That's how good they are.
They
try to
end.
Work
yes,
on
exactly.
the words. But the potential expansion of the Iraqi resistance faction's ability and their willingness to target Riyadh, if that's actually true, if this is actually what happened, then in coordination with the components of the other allied forces of the resistance, and I mean here Ansarullah and other factions of the popular mobilization units and probably other factions in Syria as well, I mean, that would for sure pose some sort of a growing security challenge to the U.S. and its regional partners as well. But I highly doubt that the U.S. is ready to allow this to happen. But in reality, what options really does the U.S. has to stop this sort of coordination between the allied forces of the resistance?
Well, we all know that the Americans and the Zionists try to, hold those remarks of, the cooperation, the rising cooperation between the allies in the region, from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. We all know that the Americans tried their best regarding what was taking place on the Iraqi-Syrian borders, for example. We all know that years ago, the Iraqi forces and the Syrian Arab army and its allies in eastern Syria, they tried to open the borders the Americans tried their best. They even came with their soldiers to the Tanf base. I think the Americans tried their best to stop this, but they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
As we all know, we must always remember that martyr General Soleimani,
yes,
he succeeded in this, in making the coordination between all those parties in the region, the liberation parties in the region, come into a successful experience, because mm-hmm. what's taking place now in Lebanon and Palestine and also in Yemen and in Iraq is a true example that all the forces that are trying to liberate their lands, they can work together. And I think that the Biden administration in the coming months and years will try to break those bonds between the allies. They can start with Yemen, for example, by trying to offer something for the Yemenis to make them to isolate them from the rest of the opponents components of the resistance axis,
mm-hmm.
to try to make a settlement or some kind of a deal of or a compromise, a political compromise, to isolate Sana'a from the rest of the capitals.
Well, that still has to be proven if that's going to work. Exactly.
It's going to be hard.
This is what I want to say. I want to say that it's a bit too late for now, and I don't think that Ansarullah are now ready to disintegrate rather than actually coordinate. I want to thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about how Riyadh was actually being targeted with drones coming from Iraq this time. Thank you very much. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
سبز و سپید نمانم من زره خاکه وطنم من This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
Senator Mitch McConnell said on Monday, 1st of February, that the loony lies and conspiracy theories embraced by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene amounted to a cancer on the Republican Party, issuing what in effect was a scathing rebuke to the freshman House Republican from Georgia. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Edmondson. The piece is titled, McConnell Says Loony Lies Spread by Marjorie Taylor Greene Are a Cancer on GOP. Stay with us for more of Katie Edmondson's article. Senator Mitch McConnell said on Monday, 1st of February, that the loony lies and conspiracy theories embraced by Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene amounted to a cancer on the Republican Party, issuing what in effect was a scathing rebuke to the freshman House Republican from Georgia. In a statement reported by The Hill, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader, never named Ms. Greene, but he referred to several of the outlandish and false conspiracy theories she has espoused and warned that such statements were damaging to the Republican Party. Loony lies and conspiracy theories are cancer for the Republican Party and our country, Mitch McConnell said. Somebody who suggested that perhaps no airplane hit the Pentagon on 9/11, that horrifying school shootings were pre-staged, and that the Clintons crashed JFK Jr.'s airplane is not living in reality. This has nothing to do with challenges facing American families or the robust debates on substance that can strengthen our party. House Republican leaders in the past week have been mostly silent as pressure mounted to respond to the cascade of Ms. Greene's problematic social media posts and videos that have surfaced in the past week, in which she endorsed a seemingly endless array of conspiracy theories and violent behavior, including executing Democratic leaders. At the same time, they are weighing calls within their ranks by loyalists of former President Donald J. Trump to strip Representative Liz Cheney, the number 3 Republican, of her leadership post as punishment for her vote to impeach Mr. Trump. In a separate statement reported by CNN, Mitch McConnell weighed in on behalf of Liz Cheney, who represents Wyoming's sole congressional district, calling her a leader with deep convictions and the courage to act on them. Mitch McConnell, who is said to believe that Donald Trump committed impeachable offenses, has made it clear that he's open to voting to convict the former president for incitement of insurrection, although he voted with the vast majority of Republicans last week to dismiss the case as unconstitutional. The twin statements by Mr. McConnell amounted to a rare step by the most powerful Republican in Washington to insert himself into an increasingly ugly intra-party feud. They have intensified pressure on Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the minority leader in the House, who is to meet with Ms. Taylor Greene later this week amid calls from outside Republican groups and some members of his own party to revoke the Georgia Freshman's Committee assignments. This leaves Mr. McCarthy on an uncomfortable middle ground after Marjorie Taylor Greene over the weekend said she spoke with Donald Trump and received his support, essentially framing any action Republican leaders might take against her as defying him by proxy. Marjorie Taylor Greene offered her own retort in response to Mitch McConnell on Twitter, saying the real cancer on the Republican Party was weak Republicans who only know how to lose gracefully. House Democrats on Monday indicated that they were prepared to unilaterally remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from her committees if Mr. McCarthy does not act, advancing a measure to strip her of assignments that will be considered by the House Rules Committee on Wednesday, 3rd of February.
Around the World with Reporters.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Ad-Dala, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4 plus 1 or maybe 5 plus 1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this, and no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
Italy's President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, gave Mario Draghi a mandate to attempt to form a new government after efforts to salvage the coalition supporting outgoing Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte had failed. Draghi, 73 years of age, had largely vanished from public view since his mandate as President of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister-designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi, arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
Russia's Sputnik V vaccine is more than 91% effective against COVID-19. The news was published Tuesday in The Lancet, a British medical journal. This is great news for all the countries already administering the vaccine and all those looking for alternative supplies.
It's unconditionally an epoch-making event. There are four vaccines in the world which published what's called the third phase of trials. our vaccine is among the three most effective vaccines in the world.
After the announcement, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said every vaccine is welcome in the European Union. The bloc's vaccine rollout is lagging behind the UK and the US, and desperate and disappointed member states, including Hungary, are looking elsewhere for supplies.
The centralized vaccine procurement of Brussels has failed. This is risking the lives of Europeans and the quick relaunching of the European economy. That's why we have looked for new sources of supply. We were the first, but it is unlikely that we will be the only ones in the European Union in this effort.
Armenia, Belarus, and Serbia have already got Sputnik V. European countries which are not EU members and say they were losing out waiting for the COVAX program, which was supposed to make vaccines available to everyone, to deliver. Countries hard hit by Western sanctions have also approved Sputnik V. Venezuela has already received its first shipment, and Iran's first batch is expected any day now. Russia has donated 5,000 doses to the Palestinians in the occupied territories as well. The World Health Organization says to end the COVID-19 pandemic, it has to be ended for everyone, everywhere. Nonetheless, rich countries are hoarding and rolling out vaccines, while the least developed nations watch and wait. It may take years for the poorest to get the jab. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tents, it's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilizing roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that of xenophobia, of populism, a resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Almost 7 weeks after the start of the vaccine rollout in the United States, the early data from the COVID vaccination process reveals African Americans and Hispanics, even those working as first responders, are left behind in the vaccination drive. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention examined two priority groups for receiving the first wave of COVID vaccinations. The examined groups were healthcare workers and nursing home residents. According to the CDC, Blacks received over 5% of the jabs despite making up 16% of healthcare workforce and 14% of nursing home residents. Similarly, Hispanics, who make up 11% of healthcare workers, received over 5% of shots. This is while white Americans received over 60% of the shots and accounted for 60% of healthcare workers. The previous CDC data also revealed that Black, non-Hispanic, and Asian healthcare workers in the country were more likely to contract COVID-19 and die from it than white workers.
Ironically, America's black and Hispanic communities are bearing the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout since its emergence in January last year. They have faced alarming rates of infections and deaths in some states. The trend is particularly visible in the recent CDC analysis, which suggests blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans died at nearly three times the rate of white Americans. Health officials have sounded the alarm for months, broadly calling for equity in vaccine distribution and access to the health care. Some experts also say the trend won't change unless the compounding factors that put these groups in disadvantage are addressed. The latest revelation of disparity is just the tip of the iceberg, as minorities in the U.S. have been facing racial bias, even in healthcare, for decades.
Well, I wouldn't say it's surprising. There has been a generational disparity from decade to decade when it comes to medical care for black Americans and Latinos. We can go back as far as the founding of this country, where there were people who were injured from the black community, whether it was from beatings and they were left to die on their own without medical treatment. Fast forward all the way into the 21st century, and we're still seeing these disparities when it comes to the treatment of not just people who are getting vaccinated, but from people who are exposed to COVID-19.
It seems marginalized and minoritized patients have and will suffer more acutely during the COVID-19 crisis in the U.S. because of decades-old bias towards the people of color. The coronavirus has once again unmasked the systematic racism, inequality, and racial gap, putting a question mark on the United States' dogma of being a just and equal society.
Yemenis gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the international silence toward the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis in the war-torn country.
We in the health sector put the responsibility on the coalition countries for the consequences of the oil crisis, as well as the United Nations, which must play its role and pressure the coalition to allow the interests of the oil derivative continues.
The Ministry of Health said the fuel crisis has pushed up the death rate among premature babies in the incubators and caused large quantities of medicines to turn rotten. This is while many health facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of closure due to their inability to generate power.
Oil derivatives are the basis for the work of hospitals and health centers, and a shortage will cause oxygen factories to stop. Hospitals will turn into cemeteries, and intensive care nurseries, cardiac catheters, and all medical devices will stop. This will increase the number of deaths.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a war on the impoverished country in March 2015, killing thousands of civilians and imposing a siege that has caused more deaths than weapons have. Babies and kidney failure patients are losing their lives every day due to the siege imposed on the country. This comes amid the silence of the international community towards the suffering of the Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's foreign minister has rejected the U.S. president's call on Tehran to return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear accord before Washington ends what Mohammad Javad Zarif called its full economic war on Iran. In an exclusive interview with CNN, Zarif said, even after Iran rolled back its commitments, it remained in full compliance with the accord.
If you read paragraph 36, we acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately to respond.
He said the burden is now on the U.S. to prove its credibility.
The side that has not been able to show that it fulfills its promises has been the United States. And as I said, the United States needs to prove its bona fides. We have already proven our bona fides.
Zarif also said Iran is ready to reverse the steps it has taken under the nuclear deal to reduce its cooperation once the U.S. returns to its obligations. Zarif said that it is possible if the coordinator of the deal's joint commission, namely the EU foreign policy chief, synchronizes the steps each side should take.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
Last week, the new U.S. Secretary of State said Iran must return to the limits set by the nuclear deal before Washington makes any move on the accord. Iran started scaling back its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after then-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the agreement. Iran did so in response to the pullout and Trump's reimposition of sanctions on Tehran. Iran also cited the failure of the European signatories to compensate for the US pullout and protect Tehran's economic benefits from the nuclear agreement. Iran says those benefits should be served if the US or others want its full cooperation.
This is the first official visit by leaders of Afghanistan's Taliban to Iran. Led by the group's top political leader, Abdul Ghani Baradar, the delegation arrived in Tehran last week upon the invitation of Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. They came to Tehran with the hope that Iran would speed up the slow-paced intra-Afghan talks that has faced stalemate in Qatar.
We asked Iran to facilitate the peace talks between us and the Afghan government. Based on the Doha Agreement, the incumbent government in Afghanistan needs to dissolve and a new government be formed that includes all ethnic and political sects. We believe that a regional country like Iran has a better right to act as a mediator.
The Taliban and the Afghan government have been negotiating in the Qatari capital to reach a peace deal, but to no avail. The peace process started after the U.S. agreed to withdraw 12,000 of its troops from Afghanistan in exchange for the Taliban halting their attacks on international forces under a deal signed between the two sides in early 2020. The Taliban says as long as the U.S. is fighting them, it is not fit to be a neutral mediator.
United States is not mediator, you know. We had a negotiation with the United States for 18 months and which reached an agreement. And based on the agreement, we have intra-Afghan negotiation. United States is not a mediator because they are the Afghans to decide their destiny and their fate independently without intervention of any country.
Tehran lays emphasis on the need to form an inclusive Afghan government that encompasses all the influential political forces. In his meeting with the Taliban delegates, Iran's foreign minister stressed that different Afghan sides need to sit at the negotiating table to resolve Afghanistan's woes. Iran had also had similar meetings with Afghan state officials, where its voices readiness to help promote intra-Afghan talks as the ultimate way to restoring peace and stability to the war-wrecked country. Taliban leaders echo Iran's proposition of an inclusive government, saying this holds the key to the end of the problems gripping Afghanistan. Tehran maintains that this would offer Afghan people the chance to have the final say in their country, a right that has long been seized in the wake of foreign intervention in Kabul's affairs. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The people of Isfahan are also among the pioneers of this movement. This is a very important achievement. We should not forget how security is ensured. The security of our borders, domestic security, the security of roads and cities, and the astonishing endeavor to ensure the safety of all those people who showed their presence on the 22nd of Bahman. Is it a minor achievement to ensure the security of that large crowd on the 22nd of Bahman with all the events that occur there? Is it a small achievement? Who are the people who ensured the security for us? Do we appreciate their value? Do we know them? May God send his greetings to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and other forces of security, the police force, the army, and the other forces which sacrifice themselves in such a manner. This revolution, this national dignity, and the security have been achieved thanks to their self-sacrifices. As for the Tabriz uprising, the 29th of Bahman demonstration was truly an uprising. It was an uprising in the true sense of the word. Of course, it occurred in one city, but it affected the whole country. It drew everyone to the arena and it led to that great and popular revolution.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 Allah.
The important point about the Tabriz uprising, which was blessed by God, was the people of Tabriz showed their awareness of time. This is the first point, and they managed to act on time. This is the second point. These two points are very important. These two elements are very significant in all personal and social events. We should be aware of time, and when we do so, when we realize that it is time to act, we should take action on time. If we do so, success will follow. If you are not aware of time, if we ignore the requirements of this issue, and if we fail to act in a timely manner, then every move will be of no avail. An example in history is a group known as the Tawabin. The Tawabin were the group of people who regretted their negligence about what had happened in Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the Holy Prophet's beloved grandson, was martyred like that, and many events ensued. Following that, the Tawabin sparked an uprising. They gathered a large contingent and they embarked on confronting the government, and the result was that all of them were martyred and slaughtered. But were the actions of 100 of them as effective as the action of a black servant who was martyred in Karbala? Were the actions of hundreds of them as effective as those of Habib ibn Mawahir, who was martyred in Karbala? The answer is no, because they did not act in a timely manner. If you wish to defend Imam Hussein, the Holy Prophet, the sanctity of Vilayat, and of the truth against the falsehood of Yazid, you should have shown your presence on the day of Ashura. You missed out on the right time. This is history. There are such examples in history. There are numerous examples in our history.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, 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 alhamdulillah. Iran today.
It survived its 40th to celebrate a 42nd anniversary. That's Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979, commemorating its 10-day dawn beginning 31st January in 2021. It begins with the return date of the first leader of the revolution, the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, all those decades ago. And it ends with the revolution. The day called Islamic Revolution's Victory Day, or 22nd of Bahman. That traditionally falls to the 11th of February. It's not the first time we cover the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, but this year our angle is how the revolution has survived over four decades riddled with hostility. Is the secret in some sort of natural resistance it has, or survival skills? Perhaps a little of both. For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Resilience is almost an undeniable attribute of the revolution, looking at its 40th. That was in 2019, when the country faced renewed hostility by America's Trump administration and their attempt at regime change in Iran, to put it in American terms. Our guest tells us what he sees as the key to the revolution's resilience or endurance. Mr. Kanani Moghaddam is himself a veteran of the revolution, with an honest look to the pros and cons of all ups and downs that have ensued since 1979.
First, one of the principles of Iran's Islamic Revolution, which has allowed it to remain a dynamic and developmental movement, is the fact that it's based on people's votes. Our revolution has been a people's revolution, and it's this support that has sustained it and made it resistant to threats and sanctions. The next point was the leadership of the revolution itself. People looked at Imam Khomeini and saw in him all the qualities of a charismatic, popular leader and a religious man. They saw a politician and trusted him. This is people's trust in the leadership. This made the people willing to send their youth to the battlefields when the revolution was in danger, such as during the Iraq-Iran war.
You say Iran's ruling system hasn't yet fully evolved. That could be good. In what direction should it evolve in order to continue its survival with the satisfaction of the people?
Over the past 42 years, we have had costly experiences, victories, defeats, ups and downs. All these experiences must be gathered to be used for reforming the structures and laws in the system and even the constitution. That is, where we see a legal vacuum, we must correct it and move forward. If we make a problematic law, we should set it aside and make more progressive laws. If we have made mistakes that have caused us to deviate from the main path, God forbid, or there have been weaknesses there, we must make up for it. By preserving the principles and ideals of the revolution and its main slogans, we must improve and address the situations day by day.
This nation has managed to establish a system of Islamic Republic and an independent system of government. That is, a government not beholden to America, but dependent on national support. You may wonder about that, looking at Iran's anti-government riots bubbling and subsiding since 2017. But over 40 years ago, Ruhollah Khomeini's slogans appealed to the people's sense of pride and independence in the face of Western imperialism and socialist revolutions. Actually, this appeal has been a lasting one and a cause of the revolution enduring all ups and downs, according to Mr. Taraqi.
One important factor that has been able to increase this resilience is looking at one's own internal capacities and capabilities and not relying on the outside and not being dependent on the external powers. Other factor is the young human capital and Muslims and believers who have been supporting the revolution, protecting it against the enemies during crises, wars, and other challenges by showing stability and resistance.
Imam Khomeini's slogans of liberation from Western imperialism and socialist revolutions shored up Iranian resistance to America. And it didn't stop there, but went on to inspire anti-Western movements across oppressed developing countries. There have been protests in Iran from time to time over economic woes created by different administrations' shortcomings and mismanagement. But Iranians are aware of the role U.S. sanctions have played in diminishing their food and medical baskets. Also, the people are aware that if there's room for criticism at home, a foreign power certainly can't be trusted with their best interests. In other words, in the face of a foreign adversary, Iranians tend to stick together. More than that, Iran is a survivor, not of 40 years of adversity, but of thousands of years of foreign tribes breaching its borders or trying to. So even the unpolitical, if there are such Iranians, do tend to join forces to pull away from foreign dependency in another way. In the face of sanctions and power threats, the Iranian nation and government alike tend to strive for industrial, technological, and military know-how to get their independence. They aspired to it before the revolution, and with 40 years gained, they have come a long way in achieving those aspirations. Today, it's dubbed resistance economy, which is to promote domestic production when sanctions block imports of goods and raw materials to the country. I asked why Iran had focused so closely on its missile industry for military independence at a time of sanctions and no imports of advanced weapons systems. Mr. Taraki is a former MP now entrusted with sensitive administrative positions. He explains.
یکی از راه‌هایی که می‌تواند دشمن رو در دوردست در واقع زمین‌گیر بکنه و اجازه
One of the factors that can ground the enemy in the distance and prevents the invasion of our country is missiles. We have reached a level of technical capability that we can produce precision-guided missiles. This means we can target only the enemy's military forces where they are operating from and won't result in collateral damage to civilians. This military doctrine is the best and most humane. This prevents incidents like those in the Yemen war, where instead of targeting the Yemeni military, Saudi Arabia bombs schools and hospitals. This is a sign of weakness and lack of humane military doctrine.
As for Iran finding its means of survival in its own domestic economy, the country's non-oil trade's gross revenues have grown 83% in the previous couple of years. And in December, the central bank governor said the nation's financial system had grown by 1.3% from March to mid-September. It is small and medium-sized corporations that are driving the expansion of Iranian manufacturing. About 1,000 of them have created or reinstated 17,000 jobs. These businesses account for 92% of Iran's manufacturing enterprises and 45% of its industrial jobs. Iran's unemployment over the previous decade has increased to 9.5% from 12.3%. Many have lost their jobs due to COVID-19, at least temporarily, say domestics barred from entering others' homes. But the above-said industrial corporations have apparently helped overall national employment figures. Mr. Mansouri narrates the revolutionary line of events since 1979. Let's hear him out.
Our national production increased last year. This shows that the country's labor force has understood the situation and is working. Most foreign goods are produced domestically. Iranians are making products including automobile parts, home appliances, and meeting the needs that were previously had to be fulfilled through imports. Now, we're entering an era when we say we can be the manufacturers of those products.
How long that